Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, art, and whomever else we can find who's out there trying to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Eric Kessel. We're back this week talking about resilience and its relevance. Last week, Xander Rose of the Long Now Foundation spoke with us about reframing time and how his work tries to get people to think differently about time and how to value it. If you haven't listened to that episode, you can find it, along with all of our past episodes, at www.socialdesigninsights.com. This week, we're also thinking differently. We're joined by Matt Sanders, who is the Resilience Program and Policy Administrator for the State of Louisiana's Office of Community Development in the U.S. As part of that work, he's also the project manager on a pioneering resettlement project on Île de Jean Charles in Louisiana, United States. Matt is a certified planner with a background in mass communication and urban planning, as well as being a Louisiana native. The 99 residents of Île de Jean Charles have come to be known as America's first climate change refugees. But in this interview, I was completely floored when Matt asked that I think of them not as refugees, but as pioneers. The more I thought about it, the more I agreed with him. Climate change is coming for us all, and will fundamentally reshape many of our coastal cities. And the residents of Île de Jean Charles are really taking a first exploratory step in what it means to adapt to this reality. For generations, all of us are going to be benefiting from their experience. Obviously, they don't have a choice. The isle has been repeatedly battered by severe weather events and is unlikely to remain above water much longer. It has also been the subject of decades of environmental degradation at the hands of extractive development and oil interests. But they are nonetheless at the forefront of many of the issues that we will all have to confront in the coming decades. I think Matt's rigor and optimism really shine through in this interview, but would rather have him explain it. Let's begin. Matt, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Matt, I'm wondering if we could start, Île de Jean Charles has become quite famous in the media as America's first climate change refugees. But I think unless you've been there or spent some time in the South, the American South, it might be tough to kind of picture what exactly that means and what's going on. Could you kind of walk us through the physical situation that Île de Jean Charles is confronting and why this project is so important?
Sure. So Île de Jean Charles itself is located in coastal southeastern Terrebonne Parish, which is probably about 100 miles from New Orleans as the crow flies. It's a location that, as a coastal location, it has always been somewhat prone to specifically surge flooding, tropical-based events. The problem with Île de Jean Charles is that much of the landmass around it has eroded away in the past 50 years or so, approximately 95 to 98% of the land itself. And so you end up with a construct in which there's one road on and off the island. It's not an island per se. It is directly connected to the mainland of Terrebonne Parish, but it's far more island-like today than I suspect it had been in the past when it was surrounded by marshland. So, it's surrounded by open water. The stark contrast I think you experience when you go to Île de Jean Charles is that it's at the edge of a federal risk reduction system alignment, which is known as Morganza to the Gulf. And so if you understand where the Morganza line is and then you have a settlement beyond that line, it's pretty stark and clear that there's not really a lot to be done over a longer time horizon to maintain habitation and settlements beyond the specific location we're trying to build protections around.
And when was the decision made to relocate the entire community?
So the community itself has known that, obviously as the land around it has eroded away and they've experienced severe repetitive disaster events over several decades, that it likely wouldn't be a location that would be suitable for habitation into the future. And so, they've talked about resettlement amongst themselves for some period of time now. We got involved in the project in 2014, early 2015. It popped up on our radar and we included it as an array of potential projects in conjunction with a response to the HUD-sponsored National Disaster Resilience Competition.
Could you define for us what the Morganza line is?
Yeah, so we have a planned risk reduction system in coastal Louisiana called Morganza to the Gulf. It's a federal levee alignment combined with pump systems and whatnot. And so the basic idea is everything inside of the Morganza line are those areas that we're specifically doing everything we can to protect from future permutations of land loss and changes in flood risk. The settlements like Île-de-Jean-Charles that are outside of that risk reduction system, you know, we don't have particularly good answers for outside of this type of resettlement project.
I didn't actually know that existed. So it's sort of like a red line, and like everything inside we're going to try and keep, and everything outside is kind of, there's not much to be done about it.
You know, it's a little more nuanced than that, just given the complexity of the Morganza project in and of itself. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear that those settlements like Île-de-Jean-Charles that are outside of the Morganza line are not likely to be habitable over time.
So for our listeners, this is certainly not the first time that a community has been forced to move because of climate change. But I think what makes Île-de-Jean-Charles so interesting is that this is probably the first time that there's been a concerted federally backed effort to move an entire community. I mean, typically when a community is facing that sort of threat, the government will gauge into a system of buybacks, right? And they'll kind of buy out individual owners piece by piece. And there's some means of cultural destruction when everybody sort of moves out individually and scatters to different places. Why was it considered a priority to keep this particular community together and to move it whole cloth?
So I think there are two basic ways to answer that question. The first approach I'll take is an economic approach. You know, we understand that the individual homeowner buyout model is at best flawed as we encounter those types of projects nationally. You know, they're often tied to a specific disaster event. They're usually predicated on a pre-market valuation of a particular piece of property. And the upshot is they often lead to a scenario by which someone is offered a buyout package that does not realistically allow for them to secure reasonable replacement housing akin to what they had on their original pieces of property. And so, you know, if we understand that the buyout model is flawed, what we're trying to figure out is if we can achieve some degree of economic efficiency in scaling that up, moving an entire community at that community scale, blending in mixed uses, commercial activities. So if we can you know, essentially set this up as if we're founding a town, if you will, and do so in such a way that it's cash flow positive, that might just be a better economic model than the individual buyout construct, while also facilitating better outcomes for the people that are living in a community that is resettled. The second answer to that question, I think, is what you're alluding to, in that, you know, we have this rich cultural tapestry in the state of Louisiana. We talk about the French and the Spanish and the Acadians and Creole populations. This particular island is historically tribal. And so, you know, you're talking about people, you know, along all of those cultural lines that I just referenced. You know, in many cases, we have clusters of communities that have been on particular pieces of property, family-owned property, for generations on end. And the ties that are in existence in these particular communities are in and of themselves valuable. The people that are there are tied to the land, in many cases tied to the water, but most importantly, tied to one another. And so in a place like Louisiana, you know, we see some social value and cultural value in figuring out if, you know, a group can be picked up like that at scale and relocated to a higher, drier, safer location.
You mentioned the sort of tribal makeup of the island community. According to the Center for Progressive Reform, a large proportion of communities currently attempting relocation throughout the Americas are Native American or Native Alaskan. And obviously there's a multi-century history there of tribal communities being displaced forcibly, in this case, being displaced by climate change. How do you begin to establish trust in a community like that, that has been told so many times, you have to move here and we promise there's going to be better land once you give up the land that you're on?
You know, I think for somebody like myself that is a representative of the government, I understand that when I walk into, you know, not just a tribal community or a coastal community, but frankly, most communities that we work with, you know, I start off at a trust deficit. And so, you know, I think we just live in an age in which there's some inherent mistrust of the government. And that's obviously enhanced when you work in communities that may have been subject to a historically poor relationship with the governments that have represented them. The way that we've tried to get around that problem through this project is just by doing the granular level, labor intensive work associated with outreach and engagement. And so, you know, we spend a lot of time on the island. We spend a lot of time in folks' living rooms, on their porches. We spend a lot of time organizing and gathering input on how we move forward on various aspects of the project, ranging from not only the design elements, but also some of the policy elements and, you know, trying to understand how the new community itself is going to look, feel, function, how it's going to replicate the attributes that we'd like to replicate from the original island, while hopefully facilitating a better set of outcomes for the people that are going to live there. I don't think there are any shortcuts, right? It really comes from good old-fashioned relationship building, and through relationship building, through a series of encounters by which you're keeping your word and you're following back up in the ways that you're pledging to folks that you're going to follow up, I think there's a natural opportunity to build trust. Now, I don't know that we're ever going to fully overcome the trust deficit that I alluded to earlier that comes from me being a representative of the government, the people that work on our team being representative of the government, and some of that past historical hardship relative to that relationship. But I think we've come a long way in a fairly short period of time and really getting to know the people that we're working with and incorporating their feedback and hierarchy of needs in conjunction with the project.
Well, it's good to know that you guys are investing so much. I mean, you guys meaning, I guess, the government. Maybe to play devil's advocate and to portray the cynic that I am absolutely not, how much is too much? You know, this project breaks down to, what, roughly $500,000 per resident in order to relocate this community. Is that fundamentally scalable or sustainable?
No, not if you do the straight line math. I think, you know, I mean, obviously $48 million divided by, you know, we last conducted a hard census of the island was in late 2016, and there were about 100 people living there. So no, just doing the math on that, it doesn't make sense. I think where this does make sense is that it's inherently, it's an R&D project. We're trying to figure out if we move a community at the scale we're trying to move it at, can we build out an array of commercial activities so that it can be cash flow positive, so that it can generate revenue. One of the things that we talk about a lot as a project team, and I also talk about publicly, is that, you know, if we're able to build out the new community in such a way that it is cash flow positive, that we are able to generate enough revenue not only to subsidize perhaps some of the costs of the residential side of the piece of property, but also, you know, present it as an attractive investment opportunity, then we certainly won't need to subsidize it at the rate that we're subsidizing this particular resettlement at. And so if we're able to prove that concept, if we're able to show that a project like this can be economically viable with a larger array of investors, then I think that will be money well spent. So it's really trying to figure out whether or not we can build a model that is, in my mind, first and foremost, economically sustainable moving forward. And it certainly won't be if it's going to cost $48 million for 100 residents.
You are listening to Social Design Insights. We hope you've been enjoying these thoughts from Matt Sanders on climate resettlement, but we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to be talking about how to maintain optimism in the face of these big global challenges and small problems as well. You don't want to miss it, so don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Social Design Insights after the break. Welcome back to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. We've been speaking with Matt Sanders about resettling climate change refugees and different ways to think about that. Let's rejoin the conversation and get down to some brass tacks. So if this is an R&D project, do you kind of work through it with an eye towards any city, any town? What are their proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences estimates that even if we stopped all carbon emissions today, there would still be 414 towns, villages, and cities in the U.S. that would need to relocate. And that's not even counting, I don't think, you know, major issues like Miami and like, what are we going to do with Miami? So in your day-to-day process, is that what you're saying, that you're kind of keeping an eye on this as an R&D project, and what lessons can we extract from it and what models can we build that might be applicable in these different contexts? Or is that an overreach?
No, I think you're very much correct. And that's the mandate that we have received from our federal partners at HUD. And, you know, we just in the state of Louisiana, we have a $50 billion coastal master plan that is specifically designed over a 50-year time horizon to provide as much structural risk reduction as possible to as large of a population as possible, but also to rebuild and regenerate as much wetland area as we can. But even if we do end up experiencing a full implementation of the Coastal Master Plan over the next 50 years, there are locations in, you know, in the 2017 version of the Coastal Master Plan there are 11 specifically, including Ile-de-Jean-Charles, that we think are going to be experiencing severely prohibitively high degrees of flood risk over time. And so, you know, we don't think that, you know, this particular place, this particular community is going to be the only time we're going to have to do this. And so if we can build a model that does work, that can be scaled, that can be replicated, you know, we very much want to take the opportunity to do so with this this investment that we've received from HUD.
What's been your hardest challenge so far?
Well, I think I alluded to it earlier in that, you know, just the relationship building aspects of the project, and that, you know, communities like Ile-de-Jean-Charles that have been subject to severe disaster events, you know, over a long-term period of time, you know, you see economic degradation. You also see, you know, in some cases, some of the social challenges that come with low-income communities on occasion. And so just trying to break down some of the barriers that have really presented themselves. You mentioned earlier some of the historical challenges that come with working with some of these types of communities that are along the coast, tribal communities. You know, just building the relationships and putting in the time necessary to do so, and really working through a nuanced set of relationships, right? I mean, communities the size of Ile-de-Jean-Charles that have, you know, family histories, generational histories in the places in which they're located. You know, it's a series of families, and like any other family, you've got, you know, some people that get along, some people that don't get along. And so, you know, really building the relationships and getting people together at a common table and attempting to build consensus has been a huge challenge for the project.
Yeah, I can imagine. And, you know, thinking outward, if you're trying to build consensus around 100 people and running into resistance, what does that look like when you're trying to build consensus around, you know, 100,000 or 500,000 or something like that? I wanted to ask maybe an overly abstract question, but do you have any sense that the sort of tale of Ile-de-Jean-Charles is being absorbed as a cautionary tale? Like, one of the things that really bothers me about the state of resilience everywhere, but perhaps most aggressively in the U.S., is that we keep rebuilding in dumb ways and in dumb locations. And, you know, even after disaster hits, it seems like we're rushing to go and rebuild in the same floodplains, the same kind of coastal sandbars and this sort of thing. Is there a lesson that can be extracted from your work that says, hey, you know, when we decide to build something, let's look out at a 100-year horizon and let's not make some of the mistakes that we did that ultimately put Ile-de-Jean-Charles in such a vulnerable position in the first place? Is there that, or am I being overly optimistic?
No, I think you're exactly right. Obviously, after a disaster event, there's a sense of, you know, the people that were impacted by the particular event, you know, they just want to get home, right? And you can understand some of the emotional sentiments that come with that. But, you know, you used the term earlier. You talked about Ile-de-Jean-Charles being, you know, the first federally funded community resettlement, the first climate change refugees. That's actually a term that, you know, we don't typically use internally on the project. And more often than not, we refer to the people on Ile-de-Jean-Charles as pioneers, and that, wow, you know, they have essentially stood up and they've said, okay, well, you know, the old way hasn't worked over a series of decades as we've experienced repetitive disaster events. You know, perhaps we can be a little more proactive and think about this construct a little differently. And I think we need to, you know, if there is a lesson learned from Ile-de-Jean-Charles, it's that, you know, when we are experiencing these disaster events, we need to be a little more thoughtful in how we redevelop in a post-disaster environment. I think if you take, you know, say Harris County, Texas, and, you know, after Harvey, you know, they're requiring redevelopment at a 500-year flood standard, which I think is a step in the right direction. You know, I think we need to take a hard look at how we're actively developing within our floodplains. I think we need to take a look at some of the data that we use that underlie flood insurance rate maps to understand what an accurate representation of a floodplain should look like. You talk about from a medical construct, you know, the first rule is to do no harm. I think from a development perspective, we can do two things. One, be thoughtful in how we develop within our floodplain so that we're minimizing at the very least the risk that we're continuing to build into the marketplace. But also in a post-disaster setting, it really is an opportunity to take a step back and to be thoughtful in how we think through our development patterns based on not only the event that just happened, but, you know, it does provide an opportunity to take a more comprehensive view of disaster risks, perhaps a little more holistically.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm looking at. And, you know, the the news about Harris County is encouraging, it does seem that, you know, we're not as aggressive as we could be. You know, I mean, after 9/11, we fundamentally redesigned the entire urban environment of the United States, right? And every elevator, every escalator, every building entrance, I mean, we really just changed everything. And it seems like, you know, we endure disasters. And at the moment, I'm thinking about the Santa Rosa fires, which happened near where I live, I guess last year. And, you know, the whole place burned down and then a bunch of people ran in and started building stuff back up. So, you know, I wonder, can we take Île-de-Jean-Charles and say, look, this land was not born vulnerable, right? I mean, it took 100 years of degradation and destroying vegetation and marshlands and large engineering projects to really create the physical vulnerability that exists there now. And maybe you're right. It's about taking that kind of long view, that 100-year, 500-year view.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And when we talk about the piece of property we're in the purchase of acquiring title to, on which we're intending to build the new Île-de-Jean-Charles community, we talk about it as a demonstration for what a quote-unquote receiver community should look like. And so if we can build out, you know, water retention, detention features, best management practices in stormwater, if we can, you know, we're making an active decision on that piece of property. There is a 100-year floodplain that does cut through the middle of the property, and there are some wetland areas that are part of that area. We're actively not going to develop in the 100-year floodplain, and we're not going to disturb the wetland areas in as much as we possibly can. And so if we take proactive measures to illustrate where we should develop relative to our floodplains, relative to our wetland areas, and then we further take the step to not only build to, say, a 500-year standard, which is what we're intending to do in the new Île-de-Jean-Charles community, but maximize a level of protection that even exceeds the levels of risk that we can reasonably anticipate, then I think we'll be operating along a horizon that, even if, you know, conditions are better or worse than we can expect over a 50 or 100-year period, we'll at least be prepared for whatever disasters may come down the road.
You use that term, receiver community. What does this community, what is it envisioned as? What does it look like?
Well, I mean, we talk about receiver communities. So one of the things that we've done a lot of planning work on in Louisiana and in Terrebonne Parish specifically is the idea that, you know, if we do have locations that are currently and will in the future be at a prohibitively high degree of flood risk, you know, where can we identify locations that are in somewhat near proximity that may be primed to receive populations over time that might move as they continually experience disaster events? And so if we can begin laying infrastructure, if we've been thinking about elements of housing density in locations that are naturally better protected from disasters, so in the case of Terrebonne Parish, just places that are at higher degrees of elevation, you know, how do we think through the development of those places that are maybe not achieving their highest and best uses along a construct of a future population, a future set of economic activities, a future set of infrastructure needs, as opposed to, you know, the short-sighted viewpoint that I think we've traditionally used, and, you know, hopefully we can get away from a little bit as we contemplate a longer planning horizon.
I'm really glad you said that, because I think, you know, I'm frustrated at some relocation attempts that seem to be, okay, we physically move you from low ground to high ground, mission accomplished, right? Job well done. And then, you know, wherever the new place is, it lacks the you know, the social constructs and the economic constructs to really provide life. You move people whose entire communities and livelihoods are around fishing or the water, and you move them 3 miles inland, well, everything collapses pretty quickly. So it sounds like this is not that, right? This is a kind of whole cloth envisioning of what this receiver community could look like and how it could sustain for the next 100 years.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we certainly don't want to be in a position in which we have to revisit this community 10 years from now and try to deconstruct all of the things that maybe we didn't account for. And so we're trying to be thoughtful. We're trying to take as much time, mindful of the fact that we're obviously in the middle of another hurricane season here in Louisiana. So there is a sense of urgency. But we understand that if we get this one right and we're able to develop a community that is holistic, as you alluded to, and does address the social needs, transportation needs, economic needs, and so forth, then it's far more likely to be scalable and replicable. It's far more likely to be something that frankly, you know, other communities may look at and see as a viable option for their futures if we do the hard work now.
Maybe last question. What keeps you going? Where do you find your optimism? I'm sure there are some frustrating days.
Well, I mean, it's an extraordinarily hard project. You know, like I mentioned earlier, the consensus building aspects of the project do lead to some contentious conversations and occasionally tougher days than others. But I think everybody associated with the project, from the community on up to me and our team, you know, we understand the opportunity that we have in our hands, right? It's not an everyday occurrence that there's going to be a national disaster resilience competition, or that there's going to be a $48 million grant specific to the development of a community resettlement model. And so, you know, there's a lot of expectation that comes with that opportunity. And I think we all are mindful of the fact that we really can't get this wrong. But with that opportunity comes, I think, a sense of, you know, creative obligation, if you will, to think through, you know, all of the different permutations that we have thought through and we continue to will think through as we design this new location and ultimately build it and facilitate the move itself.
I think creative obligation is my new favorite term. Can I steal that?
Sure.
Matt, that was inspiring and poetic, I think. And I think as we all come to grips with climate change, you know, there's a sort of analysis paralysis. And I think a lot of people are, you know, at a loss for what to do. And we're all eyeing projects like this with a sharp eye because, you know, there are going to be relocations necessary in the next 50, 100 years. In the next year, I mean, there's relocations going on now. So we wish you the best, and we're going to keep checking in on the project and follow your progress, because we're all rooting for you.
The last point you made is a really good one, in that it's very easy to get caught in this sort of web of despair. You know, you talk about Louisiana. We have, you know, just since 2005, Katrina, Rita, Gustav, Ike, Isaac, 2,000-year rain events in 2016. So, I mean, if you focus on that end of it, it is, yeah, it's naturally depressing. But I think the silver lining, I think the creative aspect, is the idea that, you know, as populations are reacting to, you know, what we're experiencing relative to the coastal condition, relative to climate change, it does present a creative opportunity to really start building out villages, towns, and ultimately, if you follow the logical path, cities again. You know, that's an exciting proposition. It's not exciting to think about a Miami that may or may not be viable over time, but it certainly is exciting to think about, you know, building, you know, whatever successor city may assume that same role.
Yeah, you know, I don't get that. I don't get why, like, designers aren't kind of more excited about this as, like, a challenge. Yes, we've invested a lot in Miami, and parts of it are going to have to change, and parts of it are going to have to move, but that is, it's a wonderful opportunity, you know, to kind of learn from the first era of, you know, American civilization and build the second. So I don't know. What keeps me optimistic is guys like you, Matt. So thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. We'd like to thank our guest of the week, Matt Sanders of the State of Louisiana's Office of Community Development in the United States, for his perspectives on this groundbreaking relocation project. Our thoughts will be with the people of Île-de-Jean-Charles. It's always striking to me that communities that have to deal with the worst and first effects of climate change are typically those that did the least to contribute to it. For all of human history, we force the poor and the vulnerable onto the most marginal and vulnerable lands, and then we destroy that too. But sooner or later, we're all going to have to look at the issue of moving. That is, if you live in parts of Miami, Boston, Lagos, Bangkok, and a million other places that are facing the same global threat. In that sense, I'm grateful to the residents of Île-de-Jean-Charles and people like them who are taking this hard step and making difficult choices. I think generations are going to be able to benefit from the work that they're doing now. Next week, we're headed across the globe to Sun Moon Lake in Taiwan. We're going to be talking to architect and developer Shay Yung Chung about the disaster recovery and different approaches to it. Shay is well known to the Curry Stone Foundation. We awarded him our prize back in 2011 based on the depth of his work. There are a lot of things we love about Shay, and I'll let him tell you about his work himself next week. But basically, he's got a humanistic approach to disaster recovery that breaks ground in multiple ways. To learn more about Matt and Île-de-Jean-Charles, please visit our website at currystonefoundation.org. There, you'll also find some further links to articles in order to assist in your research. If you have any feedback on the show, ideas for guests, or just want to chat, you can write to me at eric@socialdesigninsights.com. Also this month, an unusual double whammy. More of Matt's thoughts have been collected by our friends over at Common Edge into an editorial that you can find online at www.commonedge.org. Please go on and have a look. Social Design Insights is produced by Baruch Zeichner. And at the break, we were listening to Leaving Louisiana in the Broad Daylight by Emmy Lou Harris, which I'm going to put right back on after this because it's beautiful. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Foundation. If you haven't already, please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just look for Curry Stone FDN on all three channels for all the latest news on social impact design.